All right, FA Podcast, another episode. And this one is we're talking dogs. We're talking dogs. We're talking dog tro. We're talking, make sure your hunting partner isn't as lazy as you are in the off season, in hopes that when you get to the season, he's not as bad as we are. I'll introduce everybody. David Bingham, you've seen David, who is an MLS soccer goalie, playing for Charlotte right now. But you've seen David on the last pass with us, and you've seen his dog Nitro. Probably know Nitro more than you know David, just like you know Jet more than you know me. And then we also have Pete Fisher, who's from now, Pete, I'll let you explain what you got going on, but you rep Dogtra and you've been doing a lot with Dogtra as a consultant and some other stuff, but you've been in the dog game for how long?
More years than I want to admit. How's that? Most of my adult life, I had a fairly large retriever training kennel up here in Minnesota. Did that for 30 some years and used the Dogtra product. And when I sold the business, Mario, I actually went to work for Dogtra as a contractor.
Awesome. So what's funny, so you sold your business to who? Because
One of
this
my
is pretty interesting. Go ahead.
assistant trainers.
Craig?
Craig
Or
Klein,
who did you?
yes.
So Craig Klein was a pro staffer for Fred Zink and Zink Calls back in the day when I worked for Fred. So this is a very small business. You know what I mean? And I don't think people really understand that. So yeah, I've known Craig. I haven't talked to him in a while, but I was looking through your stuff and looking through everything, and I come up on that, and I go, "Oh my God!" I go, "This is a smaller world than people could even imagine." You know what I mean?
Yeah,
So pretty
it really
cool.
is. It really is. We live in a small world.
For
I
sure.
live about a quarter mile south of my old business on a different piece of our property.
That's
And
cool.
I haven't talked to Freddie Zink in a couple years, but I know Fred extremely well and has
That's
have
cool.
helped him out get Dogtra product over the years. And he's one of the truly finest individuals in our world that I've
For
ever
sure.
met.
For sure. For sure. You talk, we're losing, I always talk about this all the time. I've talked about it on a ton of podcasts, but we're losing those icons, if you're a Minnesota guy, then Randy Bartz and Randy
Know him
Bartz the
well.
flag man, which goes way back. And it's guys like that and Grounds. Tim Grounds, and we're missing, like, all these icons are going away, so we're kind of missing those guys and missing that leadership, in the industry. So as I come up, as David comes up, as all these guys keep going, we're just trying to keep that tradition going, you know what I mean, and
Yes.
keep the younger generation, I don't want to say on the straight path, but kind of keep them, try to teach them the right way of doing stuff, you know what I mean. And it's guys like you and guys, that are further along in their career to help us along. You know what I mean?
Exactly. I mean, those are a couple of pioneers in the industry. Randy Bartz was a great guy. I met
Oh.
him first running dogs and NARA hunt tests, North American Hunting Retriever Association events, many, many years ago, back in probably the mid-80s is when I met Randy. Super good guy. And I worked a lot of SHOT Shows for Dogtra back then, even though I had the dog training business. And so I would see him there, I'd see him at game fair, and I would see him at hunt tests. And the NARA program morphed into the American Kennel Club program.
What a great guy. Give you the shirt off his back, help you in any way that he could. Like,
He would.
what an icon for sure on the waterfowl side of things, for sure. So let's get into this. What Dave and I have been doing, we've been using Dogtra a long time, and just this past year, I kind of talked to Lorraine and everybody over there about doing more on our, social media stuff and on our, YouTube series, just because we've been using it forever. Like, I told her the collar that I had, and she was like, "You still have that collar?" And I was like, "Yeah." So she sent me like a new 1900X, right? And I was like, and which is awesome. It's like getting a new car, right? And I was like, I still have my old collar because it still works. You know what I mean? So I'm like, What are you going to say about that? And David runs, what do you run, the Edge one, or which one do you run?
Yeah, I
The
run
Edge
the
RT? Yeah. So, I mean, David's collar and my collar are both pretty old, but and we got new collars this year, which is like a new car, but we're jacked up because we just know the durability. Because I know what I put my collar through. Same with David. Like, it doesn't just come out at duck season, right? It's out all year because we're training in the summer, we're training in the spring, we're training in the early fall, and then we're hunting, and that collar's in the water, you know, for 3 months at least.
Yeah, the old product that I still have some of it when I first got involved with Dogtra back in 2002, I still have some of that product, and I don't use it anymore. But all I got to do is throw it on a charger, and it'll run. I was just down in Dallas, Texas. I worked a big canine event called HITS, and so that's Bomb Dogs, Dope Dogs, Bite Dogs,
Yeah.
and I ran into individuals there that had our old product and said, you know, it's not working anymore. And I said, how old is it? And it was best I could figure out, it was about 15 to 20-year-old product. And I said, have you ever replaced batteries? And of course, you always get this response from some people, there's batteries in that.
What?
And for the most part, they have the old nickel metal hydride battery is what's in the old product. We
Right.
still have access to those batteries. You can still buy them on Dogtra.com. All of the newer product has lithium polymer in it.
Yeah,
And
that's
obviously,
probably
we
what I
still have
have.
those. Yeah, it's a
Yeah, because
rapid charge battery.
I'm trying to think. I think mine was like a 1200
Sure.
NCP or whatever that was. You know what I mean? Like
Yeah.
that goes, I don't know how old that is, but like I said, that's still working and it's still like I can pull that out right now and go to town. It's working.
Yeah, we
So
made two versions of that back in the day. It was the 1200 NC. So that meant it had Nick and Constant, and then the 1200 NCP had Nick,
that's the one.
Constant, and Pager.
Yep.
And they were a smaller unit on the transmitter, a little bit bigger, bulkier receiver. But yeah, those we really back when I got involved with Dogtra, there were only a couple models. We had the 2000, we had the 2000 TNB, we had the 1200,
Yeah.
and a bark collar or two. So really, and now you think about it, we probably have close to 100 SKUs. And
Pretty
those
awesome.
were good old units. I mean, I love them because they didn't have all the extra technology, and quite honestly, then there's not as much stuff to break, in my opinion. So,
Yeah, then you're running into issues like David, how long have you been running yours? Because I know what I was running before and I had issues. I got to the point where they didn't charge, just threw them out. And I'm not going to name any names, but I'm just saying I've kind of been through it all. I don't know about, you know, if you've gone the same route.
Yeah, I've been running the Edge for a couple of years now, and I haven't had any issues with it. And then before that, I was running the Arc, and I still have it. It's all beat to heck right here, but it still works. I mean, they've been dropped in ponds, rivers, lakes, you name
For
it,
sure.
they've done it.
Yeah.
I switched over, so I was just running the same system for training and hunting. So I run the
Yeah.
same system for both now, and it's a little bigger, but I mean, for me, it works perfect.
Yeah, everybody needs what they want or what they need and what they're looking for. And you guys are kind of, you know, dogs was kind of covering that whole spectrum. So, you know, from like Kevin, like you know, Kevin just got pup, so he's got the other collar, he's got the little bark collar, so he's doing the same thing, you know, so everything from pups on up, like you guys have it all. And for how serious you are, you know what I mean, how much distance do you need, two dogs, three dogs, like what do you need? Like definitely you guys have it all. And you know, I'm pretty impressed with the new one just because it has pulse on it. I do like the light indicator, so in the morning I can see where the dog is. That's killer because, you know, a long time ago you'd have to buy the light and put it on separate and do some other stuff. Like all kind of brands have been like all over the road, but that's a killer function for me. So I'm all jacked up about the new one. I'm pretty excited. It's kind of brought a whole new deal to training and taking the dog out. So let's talk about this. Like Pete, like you said, you've been training and running dogs forever. You know, what we're trying to do on this is just talk about, you know, I try to run the dog every day. as you know, working around the summer in the heat and running them in the morning or running them at night. And all I'm trying to do right now, he's going to be five. All I'm trying to do is keep him up to date, consistent, running marks, running blinds, keeping him exercised, giving him water work, running him in the river so he's swimming. I'm just trying to keep him in shape and keep him focused for when it's go time. So I don't know if you got, you know, some tips. I mean, you ran a kennel, so I mean, you know this whole game.
Well, I think preseason tune-up is important both on a f physically and mentally for the dog. And so, from a physical standpoint, yeah, you want to have the dog toned up. You don't want him carrying a lot of extra body fat, making things hard on him, especially if you do any amount of upland work where the dog is going to be exerting himself. But something else that individuals forget about is, so I played high school football, and our month before our first practices, our old coach would send out a letter. This was back before email, by the way. He'd send out a letter and say, you know, guys, let's stop going barefoot. Let's start wearing shoes. Let's toughen our feet up. Get ready. You know what I mean? And that holds true for the dog as well, in that, especially if you get the lighter colored breeds, like let's say the yellow labs. And if the yellow lab carries that lighter pigment in their pads, that pinkish color, those dogs do not have the toughness that, let's say, a black would have. And so I've seen it and done it on some of my own dogs where I overexerted them running, even in grass areas, and you will wear those pads through. And of course, if you do that during the hunting season, it's like driving a car with a flat tire. So it can really, and it takes a while for it to heal up. So that's, it's important, you know, in a lot of different aspects, the physical part of it. And quite honestly, with my dogs, they get out to run and walk and work every day. I still live on 120 acres, and so that's not really an issue for me. Also, as a guy gets older, he doesn't hunt as much. So, but the mental part of it as well, keeping the dog, you know, queued up on his obedience commands. You know, the most common thing I see for waterfowl hunters is lack of control in the blind, and so that's really key to work on as best you can. Work on steadiness in the blind, in the dog hut, and you almost need to replicate that experience in the field so that you can reinforce the commands to whatever you're using: sit, stay, wait. So that's really difficult to do because the average person that lives in suburbia probably doesn't have an area in their backyard or out the back door where they can shoot a gun without spending the night in jail, and have access to birds. So those are the things you need as best you can to replicate what the dog's going to experience in the field. And even though you might have an older dog, you said yours was 4 or 5. This is the reason I had a job for 30 years, is
There's
that
no
people
doubt.
don't keep the dog up to date on the working part of it or the physical part of it. And so consequently, they would send them out to a kennel to get them back in shape. They were dogs that I had previously trained.
So they have the knowledge. They just need to freshen up. You know what I mean? Like David, like you're running Nitro as much as you can. I know you're in the heat of your soccer season, but you're still running him. Plus with the heat where you're at, so you're kind of just trying to balance what you got.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a different climate out here. So most of the dog trainers actually leave here and they go into like West Virginia or they go up to the foothills. So like honestly with Nitro, I haven't really ran him in 6 weeks just because it's been 95 degrees and 70% humidity. So I don't take my dog out in that. But you still have to keep up. Like basic obedience is 90% of hunting. It's the whole game. Nothing can ruin a hunt like a bad dog, and nothing can make a hunt like a good one. So even if you can't get out to a training ground, it's too hot, it's some in some places too cold, take them to Home Depot, get a new environment, work on obedience, and that gets their adrenaline up a little bit. So you're just getting some sort of training throughout the year.
Yeah, just sitting on the couch ain't doing it. Like, you know, like I said, you know, like, yeah, Pete, I'm lucky. Like, if I don't, I can go where the duck club is, which is 5, 10 minutes from me. I could go I could shoot, I could do a simulation, I could do the whole deal. But if I don't have time, I could run into town and just run them on one of the baseball fields or the football fields or whatever I got access to, and just a park, and just literally other dogs are there. He's obedient. You know what I mean? We're just doing anything that you guys are talking about, just keeping his mind in shape, keeping his body going, and just doing it. As we get closer to the season, it's, hey, we're gonna shoot some pigeons, or it's dove season now, we're gonna go shoot doves, or you know, whatever I can do to simulate what's going on in the blind. Like, I'll probably take the boat out at some point and just run some bumpers off the boat, you know, because we do a fair amount out of the boat. So I'm probably gonna do that. And if it's hot, he's gonna swim, we'll be okay, you know.
Well, up here in the Midwest, most of the shooting preserves, licensed hunt clubs, have opened up now, in most of them beginning of September. And there's an opportunity to go out and get your dog some preseason conditioning. Again, you got to watch it if that's the first time the dog is going out. There's a good, and most of it is upland hunting up here, on the game farm, shooting preserve, whatever you want to call them. But there's a good opportunity to spend an afternoon, a couple hours of hunting, and it's not going to set you back that much. And it's money well spent. And personally, I like to go shoot sporting clays, and that kind of sharpens my eye up. I think doing some work just similar to that with the dog on some pen-raised birds, is the dog doesn't care. He doesn't care if they're pen-raised birds or wild birds. He just wants to be out.
For sure, for sure. And the, you know, listen, the toughen up the pads and that kind of stuff, that's a huge thing that I've always had a black male. I've always had that, so I've never kind of run into that. But you know, and he's all the time on his feet and out and in the woods, or we're doing something. So, but if you're, you know, if you're black or chocolate or whatever is still sitting in the house all summer and hasn't gone out since January, you know, yeah, you probably still need to get him acclimated to what's going on, because you're talking about, you know, early cut fields, everything might be dry. You know, I think about winter wheat and how stiff it
Yeah,
is,
the
you know,
stubble,
when
yeah.
it's cut, and corn, and you're talking about a potential, you know, situation where, like you said, you run them and now you gotta sit him for 2 weeks because he's all tore up. So yeah, that's a huge deal for sure. Yeah. I think that's a great idea. And I
And
don't
the
know if
reason
people
I've
really
always
think
had
about
more than
that.
one dog.
Right. Yeah. Like, I only have one, so I gotta make sure he's like in shape and going, because if he's down, you know, I don't have, you know, David has one hunter as well, one hunting dog. Like, we can't go to the, you know, the bullpen and you know, and call in another one, right?
Right.
I don't know many guys that have that option. So yeah, if he's down, I'm down, you know. And it's not as
That's
much
nice.
fun, you know, it's not as much fun as, you know, with the dog than without the dog. So let me ask this. So, you know, we're talking, like, say we're talking about somebody who maybe their dog has sat back a little bit and hasn't done anything, and you know, their duck season's gonna start, you know, maybe late October, middle, or you know, maybe November 1 or whatever. You know, now's the time to kind of get off your butt and get him going. So, like, when you had the kennel and what you were working on, if you were doing a tune up on a dog, you know, what does that look like for, you know, a dog that's, you know, learned enough, maybe it's 3 or 4 years old, or maybe it's five or whatever. What does that tune up look like?
You know, again, it depends on the dog's level, but you know, for the most part, I trained dogs. My own dogs were performance dogs, hunting dogs. Performance dogs, what I mean by that is dogs that were running hunt tests and field trials. So besides retrieving ducks and pheasants, they retrieved ribbons for me. But the vast majority of the dogs that I trained were weekend warrior people. The dog was living in suburbia in Minneapolis, St. Paul area. Weekends, the dog was going to be waterfowl or upland hunting. And so back to David's point is the, you know, the control part of it that gets loose or sloppy all year long, unless you're doing something like I would do, where I'm training for hunt tests and running my dogs in the master level, where the performance is important, that the dog be able to mark, but also must be able to handle and be steady in a blind. And so then that becomes the, the control part of it. And so it just depends on the dog, but most of these dogs that were coming back for conditioning at the kennel, both mental and physical, a lot of times I would break it into two separate. I would do the conditioning, either running the dogs when I had them out, or I'd take them behind the four-wheeler and I'd take them in packs, and anywhere from 10 to 12 at a time. And I just take them back on my own property here. And about 300 yards back, there was a spring-fed pond, and we'd drive back there and let them run, let them swim quick, not let them tank up on water, just a little drink, and then to start up the wheeler and take off. So that would be the conditioning part of it. The conditioning and water work can be, you have to be very careful with that as well, because even though I'm in Minnesota, we get, we have just about a week or so ago, it was 90 degrees. So our ponds, our sloughs, our mechanical water over at the kennel is only 4 or 5 feet deep. And so that water gets pretty warm during the summer also. So it's not like the dog is jumping into water that's going to cool his body temperature off. So the conditioning part of it, I normally did, like I explained, but then we put the dog right back into training and then review if the dog was a handling dog, run him in the pattern field, run him on marks. And I used, I had individuals that worked for me that would throw marks, but I also have these remote control launchers. They're Thunder Launchers are the brand that I use. And so we could set those up, and I didn't have to have a helper standing out in the field. I had the dog trail electronics on it that quacks to get the dog attention. I load it with map gas, it launches. I still use these to this day, and that's what I've used to train all three of my current retrievers. And all three of those dogs are Master Hunter title dogs right now. I own three of them right now.
Yeah, I think, like you said, like it's the freshen up course of somebody who's, can only hunt on the weekends. They have a 9 to 5. They don't get to go out during the week. And then you have, the guys that do it constantly, David, myself, you, like it's an all year deal. It doesn't just happen. Like we just don't break the dog out in September and say, oh, we gotta like get to it. Like I said, we've been like the only time I'm down is if I'm traveling or like turkey season kind of derails me a little bit without the dog because we don't get to take them for turkeys or whatever. So, but yeah, and over here where I'm at, I'm in Oregon, so our water is a lot colder on the river system, just because of what it is. It is a little warmer, but it's not like you said, like sitting water where it's stuff like that. So yeah, like you said, don't think, like David's originally from California or where his duck camp is and everything else. So, you can't train in California right now. If you were putting some, if the dog was going in the water, huh, David, he'd be boiling right now out there.
Yeah, I think it was 105 at the duck camp yesterday, and you don't want to train in that. It's miserable. They also have foxtails out there in the summertime. It's a tough one. So, yeah, too hot.
So don't expect you're sending them in the water, like you said, Pete. He's gonna cool off if the water's, if the water's at 80, 90 degrees. Don't think he's going in and all of a sudden this is like he's good. You could still stress a dog out or work him too hard on the water, and I don't think people understand that enough. Like you said, the temperature, he's not in shape, they're using a lot of muscles, swimming versus running, different muscle, like stuff like that. So you really have to pay attention as well.
Right. Well, and the dog's body temperature is typically much higher than ours is. Ours is 98.6. Not uncommon to see a dog that's living outside in warm conditions to have an average body temperature around 100 degrees. So, and the dog cools himself by exchanging the air in his lungs. They don't sweat. So, yes, it does help to put them in the, to cool their body temp down by putting them in cool water, but if you're putting them in water that's 95 degrees, there's not much cooling effect that's going to go on. So, in those situations, you do have to be really be careful so you don't overheat the dog.
And I think, the thing that I seem to work on, and Jet's drive is a little different than David's dog Nitro. Jet gets distracted easy. So me, my distractions are what I kind of focus on, working into the season. Like David's saying, go to Home Depot or go to a park and there's 20 dogs running around absolute idiots because, none of those dogs are hunting dogs and are trained. And I'm thinking to myself, this is perfect because I could walk him through there and he has to listen and he has to focus on me and all this distraction and dogs running up to him and whatever. And he needs to be like, I'm locked in. So for me, that's a good thing because I want him on that level because I mean, when we're hunting, it's absolute chaos. You know what I mean? And I just need him to be focused on what's going on and pay attention, and that'll help me transition into the season, you know. Is there something that you can think of, David, because you're on a higher level than me with Nitro and where he's at, you know what I mean, as far as training. I mean, I'm not running any hunt tests, I'm not doing any stuff like that. Like you did that whole game and still like you're at a higher level than me about what you expect Nitro to do versus what I need Jet to do and where I'm at. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of time and work, but I think after duck season, I really focus on A, he gets a couple of weeks off because he's tired just like the rest of us. But give him some time off. Also, I have to go back to work, which works out nicely. I go through basically I train with amateur and open dogs, so in field trials. So I go through progression to get him back in training shape. And we'll start with marks at 60 yards, and then because as we know, everyone has their decoys between 20 and 60 yards out there, so they're used to most of the retrieves in duck season. They're right in their face, so I'm just going through the progression of lengthening him out and getting him used back to more competition stuff. So I'll go from 60 yards, and then the next week I'll throw some maybe 100, 110, and then work him all the way back out to a couple hundred yards. And it's definitely progression. And then summertime, I have to break just because the temperature out here, it's just too hot to train dogs. So we're finally at a temperature now where I can probably get out next week and start going again. So, but it's just about building him up and being realistic with expectations. I think that's a big thing for people who aren't maybe training consistently. They're expecting their dog on October 1st to perform like they did January 15th. It's not real. So, when I'm going out to training, my expectations are low on the first couple of weeks, just getting them back in the routine of things and honestly fixing everything that hunting season messes up in a competition dog. So the
Yeah, I
first
mean
2 months are a work.
yeah, for sure. If you're expecting like the light bulb to just jump off, like the other thing you got to look at is okay, coming out of the season, if you know your dog, right? Coming out of the season, was there anything that you needed to work on coming out of the season, or what was he missing, or what do you want to add, to the dog this year going into the season? Like you said, like okay, did he not stretch as far? Like was he on a long retrieve, like on a blind, like say 100 yards? Was he stopping short or looking back at you and turning around, going, "Hey, what do I do?" Where do you need to work on it? And Pete, you said it perfectly. Like it's so easy. Like everybody's situation and dog is different. So it's like, what do you want to get out of the dog this year? If you want that out of them, you got to put it in them, right? They're not just going to snap and be like, "Oh yeah, I know what, Pete wants me to run 100 yard blind. Got it." When we're only been running 40 yard blinds, right? Like that's what we got to do.
Well, what we found over the years is most people don't want to invest the time and money to get a handling dog that I would call a handling dog that stops on the whistle, takes angle backs, and does it proficiently out to a considerable length. What I find is most of the dogs that end up being what I call doing rock blind. So a rock blind is as far as I can throw the rock. And so the guy that had a dog that was a really good rock blind runner was typically the guy who had the best arm. So,
There you go, because he could throw the
yeah,
farthest.
it takes a lot of work to, to teach a dog the, the handling patterns, but then get him, dogs, for a waterfall dog, most dogs want to take the path of least resistance. And when you train at a higher level, where you want that dog to get in the water, stay in the water, carry the line, and come back the same direction. And a lot of hunters don't understand that, but when you, because they want the, they just want the bird back as fast as they can get it.
Right.
But what that also means is when you do run into elements in the field, whether you're hunting and especially when you're training for a higher level dog in competition, when that dog runs into the area where the it's faster to run the bank and go all the way around, and then he gets in trouble and you can't handle him to where the bird is at. So, you know, to get a dog to that level that is really doing that and doing it well takes a heck of a lot of work and a lot of patience on your part and a lot of knowledge on when to push the button on the remote training collar, when to correct, when to lead him, let the dog ride, let him build his momentum so you don't get a dog that's all hacky, you know, left, right, back, looks like a ping pong match trying to get a 100-yard blind that he should have done in one whistle. So it really gets to be complicated. And so if David's spending time with professional trainers, I'd love to know who you're training with, by the way, too, David. That's a big aid because the average person just doesn't get it, what it takes to get a dog to that, to be a competent handling dog for the duck blind and for sure for a performance dog.
Yeah, and guys, I'll let you go in a second, David, so you can tell people who you're training with and what you're doing. But just like you said, like, you know, some guys, if they're only hunting on the weekend or they only need the dog to do so much, like, I get it. If your dog can, you know, go back and bring the birds back from 30, 40 yards, 50 yards, and find a couple dead birds in the brush, and that's what you need, like, go for it. Like, that's perfect for you. Then that's what you spend the time working on and doing that. For guys like David or me, or guys who are expecting more out of the dog, yeah, we're constantly working with him because I want to work on this. Or, hey, last year, like, you know, he didn't push through, like you said, a hard spot. He tried to cheat the bank or do this or whatever, and then we got in trouble. Like, David's really good at the hard stuff as far as like Nitro's to the point where he's David's worked on all the hard stuff where Nitro will push through it. And if not, then he's gonna push him through it and work on that, but he knows what he's doing. You know, like, I'll just go back to this. Like you said, like Kevin is working on his puppy, and you know, he's learning how to use the collar right now because, and James is another trainer that we work with, like, and we're telling him, like, listen, Kevin, you can't use the collar unless he's doing something that you know he knows how to do it, and he's just not doing it because he's away from you and he's doing whatever he wants to do. So, you know, we're trying to teach him now how to use the collar as well, because you can't just burn the dog, you know, just because of whatever. Like, he's not doing it. If he hasn't learned it, and we can get into this puppy thing in a minute, if he hasn't learned it, you can't correct him because he doesn't know what he's doing. He's just going off the rails, right? So go ahead, David. You could talk to Pete about what, who you're training with or what's going on down there in Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, down here, I usually train by myself because a lot of the pros are gone. But back in Oregon, I was training a lot with Tellis Calhoun. He's got two dogs right now. They're doing good. He was just at the national. I think he went out in the sixth or seventh. He had the youngest dog that made it that far. So I trained a lot with him when I was back in Oregon. But out here, I'm a solo ranger just because, I mean, it's just how it is. So I'm like you. I'm out there with my mannequins, and I have thunder launchers, and I'm out and kind of doing my own thing, which is nice and not so nice, I guess, at the same point. But circling back to Mara's point about the collar, I mean, the collar can be the greatest asset you have or the biggest detriment you have. It just really depends how it's used. I mean, speaking just from my personal dog, the collar is an asset, but you have to teach them how to turn off the pressure. It's not, oh, I'm just going to burn him because he's doing something bad. They have to understand A, the command, and B, you have to understand the situation and all these things. Like, for example, if you're hunting and you know your dog can take just a straight back cast, you know he can do it, but he's not doing it, and you just start burning him to burn him. Well, did you think about A, where's the sun coming from? B, I'm assuming you're not in your white coat. You're probably in all camo, and you're probably in a camo backdrop, aren't you? So there's just certain things you have to learn when you're handling a dog in the field, especially that's maybe they're trying, they're actively trying to do what you want them to do, but they just either A, can't see you, B, there's some condition that you just don't understand. So there's just getting a new dog, and I mean getting into the training game is definitely a, I'd say it's harder on the handler than it is the dogs, honestly.
Oh, for sure. Like, Pete, I'm sure being at the kennel and having that for all the time. I mean, you're not just training dogs, you're training handlers and you're trying to train, like, listen, there's no, David and I say it all the time. There's no, and I'm sure you've heard it. Like, I've heard it off an old trainer. Like, there's no bad dogs. There's just bad trainers, right? Like, that's who's teaching the dog. So if I don't teach him, that's my failure. If Jet doesn't do something, wasn't taught to do something, that's on me. Now, if he's being a knucklehead and I taught him that and now he's, giving me, I ain't doing it, like, okay, then we got to work through that. But I can't let him go, but that's on me. So,
Well, the dog is no different than a than your kid, and they're a product of their environment.
right.
I, by the way, I know Tellus very well. Known him for years back in the day when he was on Team Water Dog,
Oh yeah,
and
there you go.
yeah, and there was I got all, we switched all those guys over that were on Team Water Dog: Rhody Best, Tellus, Scott Greer. I could go on and on. They were all using a different brand of training collar, and we got involved through a guy, I'll think of his name in a minute, Justin Tackett.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and he was the name and face behind that, and so that's how long I've known Tellus. So that dates back to before I sold the business, when I was doing work for Dogtra, even though I was still training dogs. But so yeah, and he's a good guy, and he knows he can train at a high level, so that's a good guy to hang around. I run into this at times with even with trainers, and they will say to me, "Well, that dog is very stubborn." I ran into this one and it's very stubborn, and I said, I've never really coined that and saying, this dog is stubborn or that dog's stubborn. A very dear friend of mine and is a really good trainer is Pat Nolan, and you should look Pat Nolan up. He is an old school retriever guy like I am. He uses Dogtra, but Pat does a lot of work with scent dogs, bomb dogs, things of that, and he's very innovative in everything he does. And Pat and I spent a lot of time together at SHOT Shows talking, and we talked about that phrase that this dog is very stubborn, and I don't think there's any stubborn dogs. I think it's just the individual trainer, where it's an whether it's an amateur or professional, just hasn't figured out how to way to train that dog, because there's more than one way to skin that cat,
For sure.
and so we have to think about that every time we get into a situation. Ed, David mentioned it earlier, where the dog is casting, refusing my cast, and I just can't sit back and say, he's a stubborn SOB.
Right.
How about this? We just haven't figured out the right way to do it. Maybe we just need to stop and back up. And we've all been in that situation. And I said this to one of these canine trainers over the a week ago when I was in Dallas, and he and these guys are all good people, but they don't know how to use a remote training collar in its fullest aspect, so to speak. And we use it three ways: come to me, go stationary, go away from me. And then we use it to reinforce commands the dog already knows. I've said that a million times in my life. And this guy said something to the effect that, well, the training collar, and he was saying, we don't really use them because we did had a bad experience. And one of my favorite sayings is, it's a poor craftsman that blames his tools. And he looked at me, and I said, you need to go spend some time. The people that know the most about how to use a remote training collar are the retriever trainers. Go spend an afternoon or a couple days with a good retriever trainer, and you're gonna see it used like you. Most of these people use it for a couple things. Obedience people use it for recall, get the dog to come back to them. The bite dog people, they use it to what they call an out, where they just lay a ton of pressure on the dog and he releases off the bite sleeve. There's so much more that can be done with a remote training collar, and they're not getting exposed to it. So the retriever guys, know how to use it. They've been using it longer than anybody.
Well, and here's the other thing. And David taught me this for sure, because I'm not in that whole, I wasn't buried in the training game. I've learned from James and Robin Rawls, who was out this way, who trained for a while, and then David is a lot of the is a lot of the anticipation of when to make a move on the collar or even when to blow a whistle. You know what I mean? I think trainers have that just from doing it a lot, have that intuition and have that, and that's something that you only get from working dogs and being around guys who handle dogs all the time. And like, hey, blow the whistle here because he's about to make a mistake and you can cut it off before he does it, or he's about to get in trouble and too far left or too far or whatever, and blow the whistle, or if you got to bump him with the collar at some point, it's because of this. So I'm 100% agreement on what you're talking about, because it is a tool that needs to be used, and you need to know how to use it. And like David said, or it's going to be a detriment, and you're going to do something with the collar, and you're going to turn the dog off on something.
Yeah,
True.
I think it's really important too. You have to understand when you're in this game what type of dog you have on your side. Like, do you have a Kentucky racehorse competition dog? Do you have one of those, or did you get your beautiful dog from a local breeder who runs show and you want him to go retrieve a few ducks? Those are very different dogs, and the amount of pressure it's going to take to get the result you want is going to vary dramatically. So if you treat a show dog like you treat one of these thoroughbreds, you're gonna break them. Like, it's just not gonna work. And you have to understand that. Like I always say, when you're training, when I have like a group and I'm training, I want the stuff I do in training to be substantially harder than anything I find in the field. I don't want something. I'm not training for the retrieves I'm making in the field. I'm training well beyond that, because if you're a simple example, like if you're throwing marks at 80 and 100 yards, like simple doubles in training, don't expect your dogs to do that when you're hunting and there's six or seven guns going off. And it may be a simple double, but you've added a whole bunch of different obstacles in the way there. So you need to train past what you need in the field, especially for like waterfowl guys. You need to train well beyond that level. Go train if you're able to train with like some master dogs in the hunt test, or let's say your dog's in the hunt test game and he is a master. Go train with some open dogs. Like, you need to push your training well beyond whatever your expectation is in the field.
Yeah, if you train harder, hunting should be easier. And I mean, that's just like practice. You practice hard so the game is easy, right? I mean, there's no difference in any of that. You know what I mean? Like the one thing I will say, which isn't touched on enough, is on a collar, bumping a dog on a collar for a safety issue. I have done that a few times. He's running full speed towards a barbed wire fence. You know what I mean? He's running, a huge blind back to we're in the middle of nowhere, but there's a country road and there's a tractor coming down. Like whatever the case may be, I have for sure used that. And I don't know if people really understand that part of it as well, because I'll turn that collar up as hot as I can get it, because I've seen Jet going full blast at a barbed wire fence and I got to put the brakes on because I know what he's going to do. He's not going to stop. He's going to blow right through it. And now I'm going to be at the vet,
True. And so it becomes a tool that we use to control our dogs at a distance, and for the most part at great distances, but also is a tool that we use for safety's sake, which you just described. And to your point, the different ways that we use it become a factor as well. And many people only use it in what we call direct pressure. And so if your dog was running at the fence and you yelled at him to stop, he's not stopping, he's in full gait, and you put pressure on him, that's called direct pressure. Okay. When we're working on a dog in the handling fields and we cast him, he's out 100 yards from me, and I give him an angle cast to the right, and he decides he's going to go left, angle cast, he's taken the wrong direction. Direct pressure is putting the pressure on him as he's running. What the retriever community found out many, many, many years ago, long before I was even involved with it, but because of individuals like Rex Carr and Mike Lardy and a whole host of other retriever trainers that have come since then they have learned to use what's called secondary reinforcement, secondary pressure. So the dog, rather than letting them run the wrong direction on the cast and using direct pressure with the collar, we
Right.
stop. That's why it's very important that he learns to turn back, sit his hind end on the ground, and we nick him or pressure him for sit indirectly. And people don't, until you see this work, people have no idea how this works. And indirect pressure is a much more controlled way of training a dog. We could use it another way. Let's say the dog is sitting in his hut in the duck blind. He breaks on a bird or even on the safety being snapped off on your gun or a duck call, okay? Pressure comes from the collar as he's going out, heading through the decoys. That's direct pressure. I hear him whining. I'm getting ready to snap the safety off or blow my duck call, and I think he might be getting ready to go. I tap him for sit and make him sit ahead of time, long before he ever breaks on me. That's another method that we use that we call indirect pressure. So to learn from a retriever person, this is all very common stuff. And I know, David, if you're training with Telus and the rest of them, they've been doing this for years. This is a much more sophisticated and advanced way of using a remote training collar rather than what I hate to use the term burn, and I'll tell you why in a minute, but burn and learn. Most of that was direct pressure stimulation and not the indirect. When we finally figured out as a retriever training community how to use indirect pressure and what it can get us and how much advanced our dogs are, these dogs trained with indirect pressure and direct pressure have advanced light years compared to dogs that were trained back in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, David, listen, I definitely learned indirect from David. Like he knows that, like Nitro, like he does that with Nitro for sure. So I have for sure picked that up. And I'll be the one that I'm the one that says burn because I'm not the greatest dog trainer. Like so I use that term and you said don't. So I'll stop using it because I'm learning all the time on the dog stuff. That's why I said I'm learning from James, I learned from Robin. I'm definitely learning from David, and now I'm learning, talking to you. So for
Here's
sure.
the reason. Let me interrupt you, and I'm
Yeah,
sorry
go
for
for it.
interrupting. Here's the
Yeah,
reason,
no.
because I don't want this opportunity to slip by.
Yeah.
Go ahead and search sometime. Can a remote training collar, can an e-collar, can a shock collar burn my dog? And that's what the anti-remote training collar community has used against us for years now. Guess what? We have a manufacturers association called PETT. You guys should look at it. And it has been made, it's made up of the main players in the remote training collar industry, the manufacturers. And at one on, and I'm the representative for Dogtra on one of our monthly calls here about a month ago, I just searched it and I said, for the first time, we started making some headway. And this, I believe, has to do with all the AI that has influenced our computers or the web. Okay.
Sure.
It says, in fact, a remote training collar cannot burn a dog, but it can get pressure necrosis sores or skin irritation from the collar. The unit does not produce enough energy to burn tissue.
For sure.
Period.
For
But
sure.
anyway, that's why I don't, that's old school terminology.
Well, and that's where I got it. You know what I mean?
And David as well, I know if you were standing there training with Telus, he's going to use the same terminology. But that's why I try and avoid it because of that, you guys. Go ahead.
Oh, I love
I'm
it. No, I'm all for it. Go ahead, David.
So there's only, I think there's only one, I'm trying to think. I think there's only one situation where I say burn is very applicable. If I get an out and out break, if it's an out and out break and we're in like layouts or in the boat or in
Right.
something like that, I can tell you right now it is burn time because that you don't even have time to get to your whistle. And then what's your dog gonna do?
Right.
Your dog broke. You hit the whistle. He sits straight in front of the guns. It's
Yeah,
like
burn sounds better than direct pressure faster. Right. But I totally understand what you're saying. So
yeah.
I will choose my words more carefully.
Pressure. You can use
Yes.
pressure.
Yeah.
Pressure, pressure, pressure. Yes. I'm all about it. Pete, I know you have another call, so here's what we're gonna do. We'll wrap up and I almost I almost want to come back and do more of this because I don't think an hour, 50 was enough because, we can get into actually, maybe you have some more tips on using the collar because I think more people might get a lot more out of that and actually using it and what to do. I think that will be helpful because everybody's dog's in a different situation, but the collar and the receiver, everything about the collar, if folks know more about how to use it, they probably can become better handlers, dog people, everything like that. Does that make sense?
Complete sense. And
Okay.
here's another reason is that I think education is so important with that tool.
Yes.
And it really is. It's a powerful tool. And just so you know, we've had it attempted to be banned in the city of San Francisco. Go figure, huh? Right now, we're dealing with that somewhat up in New Jersey. It's just a matter of time when it will come our direction. But what I always tell people is go on the our I actually just pulled it up here, PET.org. So it's going to come out as petpartnership.com. That's
Okay.
the Manufacturers Association. You can click on it and you can see all the major manufacturers of remote training collars, and it's our members, and they're going
Yeah,
to
I'm looking at it
be,
right now.
all right, you're going to see Dogtra, you're going to see Dog Watch, which is Fred King and Charlie King's business up in the Northeast. You're going to see DT Systems based out of Texas. PetSafe is all under one group. PetSafe, Sport Dog, and Invisible Fence is Radio Systems. And if you look very careful, you will see some manufacturers that should be on this list and are not.
And are not.
They are not. And they are
That see
not because a lot of
that's huge.
reasons, and I have no idea why they're not, but they're not.
Yeah, I see it right now. Yeah, that's huge. That's a huge deal, just so you know what you're dealing with. You know, when
Yes.
you're shopping for collars and looking and stuff like that, that's a huge deal right there.
These are companies that are looking out for your best interest, your ability to use a remote training collar in the field on your pet dog. And it really is, I think it's very important. And those are the key. There's really not as many manufacturers as you think. There's only about two major manufacturers missing from that. But right now, here's what we're seeing, you guys. We're seeing all this crap that's coming on Amazon from these Chinese companies. You can buy
Sure.
remote training collars for $49.50, and
Well,
it's
yeah.
just junk.
Yeah, they're gonna private label some junk, like for sure. Like, listen, the pet partnership, as soon as you pull up that website, it says one thing that's probably a key thing. It says using technology to keep pets home, happy, and safe. And that's really what we're trying to do. We're trying to educate them. We're trying to keep them safe. We're trying to keep all. So all that makes sense. That's a huge thing, Pete. I appreciate that. That's pretty cool. So let's do
Well,
this. Let's go ahead. Go ahead.
now you can have me back. We'll talk
Absolutely,
more.
I think.
I don't have to run right at this moment, but I don't want to cut you off either.
Yeah, no, you're fine.
But no, I'd like
Dave
to come
is.
back on. I really didn't know. I looked. Lorraine said, "Hey, you're going to get on this podcast,"
Yeah,
and
for sure.
I didn't know. And then all at once, I searched you guys a little bit, and I look at David Bingham, and I'm like, "Well, he's a soccer player."
Yeah.
I didn't. I educated myself as I'm getting on. And I've done a lot of podcasts, as you can
Yeah.
tell, but this was good. You guys did a nice job with it. So thank you for having me on.
Yeah, David's hardcore on the dog side for sure. Like David chases snow geese is probably his favorite thing, and then ducks maybe
Okay.
next. But he is a dog guy through and through. I have always been a dog person, but I'm the one that's probably lacking in all the terminology and training. And I've just learned as, I've gotten better each dog and each season, I guess. You know what I mean? So that's where I sit. I'm on personally on my third dog. And, the only thing that I can say is every dog I've had, I've gotten better and the dog's gotten better. And that's what I'm trying to do. You know what I mean? Am I trying to get to the hunt test or to David's area? I'm not sure I want to go that route. But when somebody sails a duck, 200 yards in some grass, low spot, and I could get jet there, I feel pretty damn good, or if it's 300 yards or 400 yards up in Canada or whatever, and I send him on a sailer, I know he can do it because, David and I have worked on stuff like that, and my buddy James, and like we've put the work in. So that feels pretty damn good.
It does. And
You
you
know?
should.
Yeah, because all that time, it's time. Just like all of us. Awesome. All right, let's do this. So, Pete Fisher from Dog Trail, the representative, and helping us out with all this stuff. We're going to have him back on. David Bingham, you guys know from the Last Pass series on YouTube. If you want to find more info on Dog Trail, go to the website. Dogtrail.com is super easy. You could find it. You could look us up at Final Approach. You could check all our sponsors and partners that help the podcast go. Federal Ammunition and Leupold and Roger Sporting Goods and Saskoose Company and Weatherby, of course. So all of us are, just trying to bring education and fun stuff and hunting stuff and just, bring it to the forefront. So Pete, thanks for being on with us, and we'll definitely have you on so we can talk more caller stuff. And that's our Final Approach podcast for today. Appreciate you guys checking it out.
Thank you both. Thank
Thank
you.
you.